Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Psalms chapter 58. We'll call this psalm, God Who Judges the Earth. The heading of the psalm says this, for the director of music, to the tune of Do Not Destroy, of David, a miktam. All right, let's tackle the header first, the heading, which of course is not necessarily inspired, but it's probably accurate. We see that this was a psalm of David. The psalm was to be sung to the tune of Do Not Destroy, which is the same tune that was used for a previous psalm. I don't know which one, I forgot. I don't have it written down, but must have been a popular tune, Do Not Destroy. This psalm is said to be a miktam. Well, what is a miktam? The NIV note says, the marginal note says, it's probably a literary or musical term. Wikipedia says that miktam is a word of unknown meaning found in the headings of Psalms 16 and 56 through 60. Questions.org has four speculations as to what a miktam is. Speculation number one, the root of the Hebrew word translated miktam, or transliterated miktam, the root means engraving, so the idea is that the psalms, which were labeled as miktams, were so valued that they were engraved upon tablets for preservation. GotQuestions.org speculation number two, the word miktam means golden, so the psalm would be considered as valuable as gold. GotQuestions.org speculation number three, miktam is a technical term to guide the singer. Speculation number four, miktam is a technical term to denote the tune. Nobody really knows what a miktam is. We start now in verse 1. Verses 1 and 2, actually, in Psalm 58. Do you indeed speak righteousness, O gods? Do you judge uprightly, O sons of men? No. In heart you work unrighteousness. On earth you weigh out the violence of your hands. Now we have a problem here. Why does David rail against gods? This psalm is not really a psalm against idolatry. Well, it has to do with the translation. So let's look at some options for translations. The translation I just read is the NASB, and it has gods. Now, the same Hebrew word for gods in Psalm 58:1 is translated by the NASB in Psalm 82, verse 1. As rulers, God takes his stand in his own congregation. He judges in the midst of the rulers. The KJV, by contrast, in Psalms 82:1, translates the Hebrew word as gods. God standeth in the congregation of the mighty. He judgeth among the gods. So rulers and gods, as I'm sure you know from other context, are the typical way that little g gods are looked at in the Old Testament as rulers, political leaders. And in fact, the NIV translates Psalms 58:1. Do you rulers indeed speak justly? So the NASB has, do you speak righteousness, O gods? And the NIV says, do you rulers speak justly? So those are your two main options there. Now, another option is the KJV translation, which is this. Do ye indeed speak righteousness, O congregation? Instead of gods or rulers, they say, O congregation. Well, John Gill says what the KJV means there is the congregation of the mighty, which is the same thing as the congregation of rulers. So it's a little bit off the wall, but it's the same idea as rulers. Now, there's another possibility, which no translation that I know of uses, but John Gill says that the word literally means dumb. Are you dumb? You should speak righteousness. John Gill paraphrases. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says that the Hebrew literally means, oh, dumb. Maybe, oh, dumb ones. I actually looked this up in an interlinear Hebrew lexicon, and sure enough, the word means silent. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says the word is never translated as congregation. So I don't know how in the world in the Hebrew we go from silent to rulers, but I don't know Hebrew, so I'm at the mercy of the translators. I'm going to assume it's rulers, because what is David saying about gods? I mean, the psalm has nothing to do with gods, but it does have to do with rulers, namely one particular ruler who's trying to pin him to the wall with a spear, and not only Saul, but also Saul's henchmen, his courtiers, if you will. David says in verse 1, do you judge uprightly, O sons of men? Of course, that's in parallel with the rulers, so that means he's talking to the rulers. Are you judging uprightly as you allegedly carry out, ostensibly carry out your God-given duty to judge the people? Are you doing that uprightly? No, you're not. Verse 2, no, in heart you work unrighteousness. On earth you weigh out the violence of your hands. Weigh out the violence of your hands, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown interpret as you give decisions of violence, because weigh is a figure to express the acts of judges, as, for example, to weigh out justice. And so these rulers are weighing out, instead of justice, injustice, which leads to violence. I'm sure David is thinking about that spear that almost nailed him to the wall, and those people who were hiding around his house to get him when he came out in the morning so that he would be dead. Now, violence is especially bad for rulers or judges. It's bad for crooks, bad for anybody, but rulers and judges, when they're violent, bureaucrats have more power than kings in all countries and all times, in my humble opinion. I'm thinking about America, but it's true everywhere. Here's what the NIV Study Bible says about the violence of rulers. Quote, most likely they were distorting justice. Perhaps these were judges or other leaders who had accepted bribes or misused their powers. Whatever they had done, David expressed his frustration over his inability to weed out these bureaucrats who were creating havoc. We go down to Psalms 58, verses 3 through 8. David continues, the wicked are estranged from the womb. Those who speak lies go astray from birth. Notice the parallelism there, from the womb, from birth. Verse 4, they, the wicked, have venom like the venom of a serpent, like a deaf cobra that stops up its ear, so that it does not hear the voice of charmers or a skillful caster of spells. O God, shatter their teeth in their mouth. Break out the fangs of the young lions, O Lord. Let them flow away like water that runs off. When he aims his arrows, let them be as headless shafts. Let them be as a snail which melts away as it goes along, like the miscarriages of a woman which never see the sun. Well, David, tell us how you really feel. Let's start with verse 3. The wicked are estranged from the womb. What does that mean? It means that their nature was sinful before they did a sinful act. Because when a baby is born, he has not had time to do any sinful acts. But by nature, he's a sinner because he inherited a sinful nature from Adam. This verse is quoted a lot by Augustinians, by Calvinists, who like to point out the depravity of mankind, the T in total depravity, total inability to choose God. The wicked are estranged from the womb. They come out of the womb. They're not looking for God. They're suppressing the truth and unrighteousness as soon as they start wailing. Now, here's some other scriptures that talk about being sinful from the time of birth. Psalms 51:5. This is David speaking. Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. Isaiah teaches the same doctrine, that we are sinners from birth, in Isaiah 48:8. You have not heard, you have not known, even from long ago your ear has not been opened, because I knew that you would deal very treacherously, and you have been called a rebel from birth. From long ago, when you were a little tiny baby, you've been a rebel from God. Now at the end of verse 4, Paul says that the wicked are like a deaf cobra that stops up its ear. Now the first part of the verse is very easy to understand. The wicked have venom like the venom of a serpent. No need to explain that. But the snake in the second part of verse 4 is kind of interesting, like a deaf cobra. What does that mean? Well, the best comment on that was from the Benson commentary, who said this, quote, no arguments, persuasions, or efforts that can be used can mollify the envenomed malice or change the disposition of these men. They are deaf to all my counsels, to the dictates of their own consciences, and to the voice of God's law. Nor will they hearken to any instructions, remonstrances, cautions, or advices, however reasonable and proper, excellent, or necessary they may be. That's what the verse means, obviously. They don't listen to God. They're like a deaf cobra. But the interesting thing is what is the metaphor referring to? What's the physical object that is supposed to conjure up the idea of somebody that doesn't listen to God? What's a deaf cobra? Well, let me read again from Benson. Quote, the psalmist here alludes to a prevailing notion in those countries that all serpents, except one particular species, might be so influenced by some sort of music or verse as to be disarmed of their rage and power of doing mischief, and rendered gentle and innocent. So basically, snakes could be charmed, or cobras in particular, they could be charmed. They're still doing that in India. But this is a special kind of cobra. This is a deaf cobra. And the deaf cobra is said to stop up its ear. What does that mean? Options I will now give you as to what sort of snake this is. Option number one, these options are all from Benson. Option number one, the snake is deaf in one ear, and he would stop the other ear up with his tail. Now, Benson denies that, saying this seems so improbable as to be hardly worth noticing. For why should the God of nature give any species of creatures two ears and yet design one of them to be always deaf. I think that's a good point. I don't believe this is a one-eared cobra that stops up his good ear. Option number two, this is a snake that lays one ear on the ground and stops up the other one, either with his tail or by putting dust in the ear. Nature having such strange creatures in it, that wouldn't surprise me as being possible. Third option from Benson is that this snake is deaf by accident. It accidentally got hit by something or attacked by an animal and he lost his hearing. I don't think so. Or maybe the snake is deaf by birth. Now, that's possible. Animal being born, because that's his species. His species doesn't have ears to hear, in which case the stopping up its ear would be metaphorical, not literal. Well, whatever it is, that's interesting. It's a little rabbit trail as to what kind of snake is being referred to here. And here's some more information on the rabbit trail. Shakespeare liked this image. According to Benson, he used it a good bit. And here's an example from Troilus and Cressida. Shakespeare says this, "Pleasure and revenge have ears more deaf than adders to the voice of any true decision." In other words, people eating up with pleasure, eating up revenge, they can't hear any wise decision as to what they should do. More deaf than adders. Now, Shakespeare makes it sound like that all adders are deaf. I remember reading one time, a long time ago, that the way snake charmers charm snakes, or snake handlers, I should say, in these backwoods in Tennessee churches where they handle snakes, is that the music plays and it creates a rhythm that kind of dulls the sensibility of the snake, and the snake naturally can't hear, but he can feel vibrations. That's how he hears. And so when he feels all that rhythmic music, it kind of numbs him into inactivity, and so he won't bite anybody. I don't know if that's true or not. I just read it years ago. But anyway, enough of snakes. We go now to verse 6. David says, "O God, shatter their teeth in their mouth." These are his enemies. "Break out the fangs of the young lions, O Lord." The Holman Christian Study Bible says, "Break out the great teeth of the young lions," which makes more sense to me. You don't break fangs unless a fang is a tooth. But at any rate, David is talking about breaking some teeth of his enemies. Now, that's not very nice. Well, this is another example of an imprecatory wish on the part of David. He wants his enemies to be blasted. There is nothing wrong with that, as I've said over and over again as we go through these Psalms. I discussed it in great detail in the audio on Psalms chapter 1. David is a political figure. He is supposed to mete out justice. Not like these gods, these rulers who are meting out violence and injustice. He's meting out justice. And you've got to meet violence with violence when you are a judicial or political leader. That's just the way it is. And I ask you, would you feel bad if David had said, "Adolf Hitler, God smash his teeth"? Would you feel bad about that? How about Pol Pot? "Hey, Pol Pot, I want God to smash your teeth out." Would that really bother you too much as you look at those piles of human skulls that he put there in Cambodia? How about Mao Zedong after he killed 38 million people in the Great Leap Forward in the 1950s? Would you feel bad if I said, "God, break out the teeth of Mao Zedong"? And I could say the same thing about Xi Jinping. "God, break out the teeth of Xi Jinping as he incarcerates and beats and tortures millions of Uyghurs in Xinjiang." There's nothing wrong with this. In fact, people who are embarrassed by these imprecatory psalms, they've been totally soaked in modern American culture or modern Western culture. They don't understand the justice of God. David just wants some justice. He wants to be preserved too. This is not revenge he's asking for. Now, that would be sinful. He's not asking for revenge. He's asking for protection, self-defense, and justice. There is nothing wrong with that, evangelical wussy-pusses. Verse 7, David says, "Let his enemies flow away like water that runs off. When his enemy aims his arrows, let them be as headless shafts." You shoot an arrow with no arrowhead, there's no weight on the shaft, and so the shaft wanders aimlessly in the sky. It doesn't go where it's aimed, and not to mention the fact that if it did go where it was aimed, it wouldn't do any damage because there's no head on the shaft. Verse 8, David says, "Let his enemies be as a snail which melts away as it goes along." Now, I thought about that. Why does a snail melt? Well, I remember as a kid, pour salt on snails to watch them melt. I thought I did that. I don't know if I ever did that or not, or whether I just saw movies of it. So I had to look it up on the internet to make sure my memory is correct. And sure enough, you put salt on a snail, and the salt dehydrates the snail and makes it melt. So maybe that's what David's talking about. I assume that he had salt to put on a snail, or that people back then had salt to put on a snail. The website I checked this on said that many people get disturbed when they watch a YouTube video of the salt melting the snail. It is sort of gross. They're disturbed, but over 1 million people have watched the video. So, too bad, Peter. You're not going to get people upset about snails melting with salt. There's another option, though. One of my commentators said that snails melt when they come out of their shells. They're supposed to stay in the shell for protection. Maybe they melt, probably because they get dehydrated. But at any rate, that's what David wants to happen to his enemies. He wants them to melt. Another unpleasant fate for his enemies, David mentions, is that he wants his enemies to be like miscarriages of a woman which never see the sun. He wants them to die. He wants them to be dead. Does that make you feel bad? After having watched Adolf Hitler shoot all those naked Jews and the Nazi soldiers kick them into the pit, you feel bad about saying, God, I wish Adolf Hitler had been like a miscarriage that had never seen the sun? I don't. Reminds me of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a pacifist. Oh, Christianity says you can't kill people, even bad people. He ends up getting involved in an assassination plot of Hitler when he finally saw evil face to face. And I think that so many of these ivory tower evangelical Christians are sitting around, oh, I'm embarrassed by David. This is the Old Testament. It's not the New Testament. If they would really read some history and get a feel for what it's like to look evil in the face, like Adolf Hitler or Pol Pot or Mao Zedong or Joseph Stalin, they wouldn't be so foolish and embarrassed about these imprecatory psalms. We go now to Psalms 58, verses 9 through 11, and we will finish this audio. David continues, before your pots can feel the heat of the thorns, whether green or burning, he will sweep them away. The righteous one will rejoice when he sees the retribution. He will wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. Then people will say, yes, there is a reward for the righteous. There is a God who judges on earth. Now the Hebrew in verse 9 is obscure. The translations differ a good bit. I'm using the Holman Christian Study Bible because it's the closest translation to the original Hebrew that I saw. Before your pots can feel the heat of the thorns. Well, let's just take that. Thorns are quick burning. You put thorns under a pot and you light them. The fire gets going very quickly and that pot feels the heat. And so the point is the judgment, the heat, comes very quickly, and that's what's going to happen to David's enemies. They're going to get swept away very quickly. That's easy enough. Now, the NIV note says the meaning of the Hebrew for this verse is uncertain. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that though obscure in its clauses, the general sense of the passage is clear. And it is. That's the general idea. Retribution is coming quickly. Now, the next phrase is very difficult. Before your pots can feel the heat of the thorns, whether green or burning, whether green thorns or burning thorns. Well, that makes no sense to me at all in the Holman Christian Study Bible. What's the difference between a green thorn and a burning one? Is a green thorn that doesn't work, doesn't burn, and a burning thorn is a dry thorn, brownish gray thorn that burns very quickly? Well, if that's so, what's a green thorn doing under the pot? Does a green thorn burn? Does it burn quickly? Probably not. So I went to the Young's Literal Translation, and I read this, before your pots discern the bramble, as well the raw as the heated, he whirleth away. Whirleth away his enemies. And so this is my stab at the meaning. The pot can either feel the prick of the green thorns or it can feel the heat of the burning thorns. Before either possibility happens, David's enemies are swept away. Now, I don't know if that's what the Hebrew means, but I don't think anybody else does either. So that's what I'm going to go with. We go to verse 10. David says, the righteous one will rejoice when he sees the retribution. Oh, Schadenfreude? Is this rejoicing over the demise of one's enemies? No, this is rejoicing over the establishment of righteousness. Schadenfreude is personal revenge. It's personal. It's not being happy over righteousness being done. There's a difference. It's a huge difference. But in verse 10, the righteous one will rejoice when he sees the retribution. In other words, judgment coming on his enemies. The righteous one will wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. That's kind of gross. What does that mean? Well, here's a couple of options. Option number one, it could refer to the custom of washing one's feet back then. The usual custom was to wash feet in water, but there would be so much of the enemy's blood around that water would not be available and blood would have to be used. Or it could simply mean that the righteous will wash his feet in the blood of the enemy is because the righteous could not go outside of his door without stepping into the blood of the enemy. Whichever way it is, the point is, ho, ho, ho. God's righteousness is established. Verse 11, then people will say, yes, there is a reward for the righteous. All this suffering we go through, all this having to suffer the injustice of the sinners of the world, like Lot, who had his righteous soul vexed in Sodom, like American Christians who have to look at their country swim in a pile of feces, moral feces, to have to watch transsexual sexual perverts in the cabinet of the President of the United States telling us that he wants the medical profession to perform puberty blocking and gender assignment surgery on innocent kids before they're old enough to know their left hand from their right hand. We are awash in moral filth, and we have to watch it, and we have to see it, and we have to endure it. But David says, yes, there is a reward for the righteous. There is a God who judges on earth. And I'm telling you, one day God is going to judge the United States of America like we ain't never been judged before, and it's already started. God's judgments are generally slow in order to give people time to repent. Well, people better get busy on the repentance job, because things are getting worse and worse here in this country. By the time you listen to this audio, I'm not even sure this country's going to be here. And if it's not, that means God will have made America suffer its condign judgment. We will have gotten exactly what we deserve. Now notice in verse 11, in the last part of the verse, David says there is a God who judges where? On earth. God's judgment is not all reserved for judgment day. We are able even to see God's judgment on earth today. For example, where's Pol Pot? Where's Adolf Hitler? Where's Joseph Stalin? Where's Mao Zedong? Assuming they didn't repent before they died, which I doubt they did, they're all roasting in hell. At any rate, they're not on the earth killing people anymore. So God makes his justice, makes his rain shine on the just and the unjust. He will protect people before the killing goes so far as to wipe out the human race. There is a God who judges on the earth. Other scriptures that say the same thing, Psalms 96:10, the author of this psalm is unknown. The psalm says this, "Say among the nations, the Lord reigns. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity." No one world dictator is going to take over this world. God is not going to let that happen. Psalm 97:1, the author of this psalm is also unknown. "The Lord reigns. Let the earth rejoice. Let the many coasts and islands be glad." Why should the coast and islands be glad? Because the Lord reigns. Not the devil. The Lord reigns. The Lord is the Lord of this earth. It's true that the devil is the god of this world, the world system, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, but God rules over the devil. With those happy thoughts, and of course David always ends his psalms on a happy note, we're now finished with Psalms 58. And we're now prepared to go to Psalms 59 in our next audio. I'll call Psalms 59, "Deliver me from my enemies." That's a constant refrain of David. He was full of enemies. He had more enemies than Donald Trump does. So we'll take that psalm up in the next audio. I hope that you enjoyed this audio, and I hope you stay tuned for the next one.